From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will shovel snow for Vikings tickets, or maybe just $10 an hour. Ahead on Only a Game, the wintry Metrodome morass and the Vikings contingency plan. Also, the Canadian Women's Hockey League looks to go pro. Helene Elliott wishes hockey holidays to all. And Terry Pluto talks about his new book, Things I've Learned from Watching the Browns. Also ahead, and just in time for the holidays, it's the fourth annual Gingerbread Trailer Park Competition.
It is a lovely subdivision of two trailers. We've got some mock inflatable snowmen and gingerbread men. We do have shoes hanging from the telephone wire and the requisite tires that line the path. We're going to win. We're confident.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Over the past 3 weeks, the New England Patriots have scored 126 points. Their opponents have combined for 34. It's been a long time since anyone would characterize a successful team coached by Bill Belichick as surprising, but at 11-2, the Patriots are outperforming most prognostications. Joining me now to discuss the Patriots and the NFL's other Super Bowl hopefuls is Mike Reese of ESPNBoston.com. Mike, welcome back to Only a Game.
No, thanks for having me.
New England was 9-2, but the buzz surrounding the team really got louder after the Patriots blew out the Jets and the Bears over the past 2 weeks. What is driving their success?
Well, if I had to start with one thing, it would be quarterback Tom Brady. You hear people say it all the time about the game of football. The quarterback is the most important player on the field because he always has the ball in his hands. Tom Brady is playing as well as he's played over his 11-year career, and that's saying something because he's had some great moments over his career.
Some observers questioned the logic of trading wide receiver Randy Moss earlier this season. Shortly after the deal, the Patriots made another deal to bring former Super Bowl MVP Deion Branch back after he'd spent a few seasons in Seattle. Most receivers would love to play with Tom Brady, but why is Brady so excited to have Branch back?
Well, one of the things that's sort of been unsaid is that I think Tom Brady felt a little bit of a mental pull to keep Randy Moss involved. Randy Moss was entering the final year of his contract, and he knew he wasn't going to have as good statistics this year as he did last year because the offense was changing. With Randy Moss no longer on the team and Deion Branch, who is going to care less about his statistics and be more appreciative of being back in New England where his talents could be maximized, it sort of takes a little bit of a burden off Tom Brady. In a way, he's almost been liberated a little bit.
The Packers visit New England on Sunday night, and they will most likely be without quarterback Aaron Rodgers, who suffered a concussion last weekend. How do you like the Packers' chances tomorrow and beyond?
Well, if they have Aaron Rodgers, I like their chances. They're playing for their playoff lives, if you will, and I think they're a good team with a very good defense, a type of defense that could hurt the Patriots. But the drop-off between Aaron Rodgers and the backup quarterback, Matt Flynn, is significant. And if Rodgers doesn't play, I don't like the Packers' chances.
Regarding that concussion that Aaron Rodgers suffered, is there more pressure on teams to keep players out an extra week, perhaps, because of all the talk about head injuries and ongoing problems?
Yeah, there is, and I think that's a good thing, Bill. The awareness to this issue is out there now more than it has in the past, and the fact that Rodgers in this critical spot for the Packers, they need this game to win. The fact he might not play, I think it's a good sign for where things are right now.
Despite Ben Roethlisberger's suspension earlier this season, the Steelers are in first place in the AFC North. Pittsburgh hosts the Jets tomorrow. The Jets are in a bit of a nosedive. They've lost two games in a row. So this is a big game for both teams. Who do you like?
I like the Steelers in the game because they're at home, and of course, you know, one of the things they'll be coached up on is watch out on the sideline when you're over on that Jets sideline.
They suspended that guy who tripped the opposing player. You mean they got another guy over there ready to pull that stunt?
You never know. You never know. No, I do. I like the Steelers. They're tough at home. They're also playing good football. They've won 4 games in a row, and they've done it in different ways. And probably the thing with them that's most impressive is that they got off to that good start without Ben Roethlisberger. I think that built a lot of football character. You hear that term thrown out a lot, but when you can win without one of your top players, it sort of builds confidence among players.
In the NFC, Michael Vick's success in Philadelphia has earned him a lot of attention, but Vick's former employer, the Atlanta Falcons, this is the only team besides New England with 11 wins. Is this the year quarterback Matt Ryan and company make a deep playoff run?
Well, as long as they get home field, I would say yes. And the key game to look at is going to be December 27th when they host the New Orleans Saints, the defending Super Bowl champions. The Falcons should win this week at Seattle, and that sets up that huge game against their division rival, the Saints. The Falcons are a different team when they play inside in that Georgia Dome. So tough to beat there with Matt Ryan. So if they win that game, I'd say absolutely this team is set up for a deep run in the playoffs.
Mike, the Giants and the Eagles are battling for the NFC East division title, but the Redskins are stumbling. According to the Associated Press, Washington will bench Donovan McNabb tomorrow in favor of Rex Grossman. So, good thing McNabb finally got away from those quarterback controversies in Philadelphia, eh?
Exactly right, and I think this is one of those situations we have to credit the Philadelphia Eagles for making a very tough decision. When they traded Donovan McNabb, a lot of people were saying, what are you doing trading this guy, a franchise icon, and what are you doing trading him to a team that we play twice a year in our own division? So I think you look at the way things have unfolded and you say, well, maybe they knew what they were doing after all.
Meanwhile, the race to the bottom is on in the NFC West, where all the teams are under 500. Will we see a division winner with a losing record hosting a playoff game next month?
You know, I think we will, and it's going to really spark the debate on if they should change the way you seed teams in the playoffs, because it's been a given that if you win your division, you get that home playoff game. And a couple of years ago, owners talked about changing this, and one of the owners, Carolina Panthers owner Jerry Richardson, gave a very passionate speech to his fellow owners and said, we need to keep things the way they are. It's a reward for the fans, our season ticket holders. They know that if you win your division, you get that added game, and I think that speech really galvanized a lot of the owners to say, let's keep it the way it is. But if you see a team with a losing record hosting a game, perhaps that will change this time around.
Mike Reese covers the Patriots and the NFL for ESPNBoston.com. Mike, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
At an in-town Atlanta bar, an unusual competition is gaining traction as a holiday favorite. Participants say it's an event with more sugar than the Sugar Bowl and even more festivity than the Fiesta Bowl. Reporter Philip Greatzer attended the 4th annual Gingerbread Trailer Park Contest, and he has this report.
Chantel Ritter got the idea for gingerbread trailers when she visited New Orleans a few years back and saw FEMA trailers decorated for Christmas. She figured the trailer motif was ripe for Christmas exploitation.
I thought that gingerbread shouldn't be limited to Victorians and little cabins, when in fact trailer parks are one of the most decorative Christmas things you see.
The design and decorating contest has only a few rules. The trailer park has to fit on a lot the size of a case of beer. Ingredients other than gingerbread can be used, but the entry has to be 90% edible. And no meat is allowed.
But changing the building thing to like no gingerbread required just really turns it on its head, where they can build with sugar wafers and pretzels and like crazy stuff.
Tonight at the Euclid Avenue Yacht Club, a bar 250 miles away from the Atlantic Ocean, competitors dressed in Santa's helper suits and hats or their finest Happy Birthday Jesus t-shirts are pimping their entries for the crowd. Cresta Schaefer just moved to Atlanta.
I just think it's a very fun twist on a Christmas classic. We're the ho-ho hoarders, so we've got our trailer and our little white trash couple and lots of piles of trash around the place. We're winning.
She and 4 of her friends spent several sober days building their trailer park.
Honestly, there was no drinking involved. We just have messed up minds.
Although a few of the trailer parks are Christmassy cute, Jolene Beckett knows that to win in this sport, you have to be more naughty than nice.
Our exhibit is Loretta Mae Sanders Trailer Park, and it is a lovely subdivision of two trailers, and it is lit up with gorgeous sparkling lights. We've got some mock inflatable snowmen and gingerbread men, a couple of dogs in the yard, and one very large orange marzipan cat peering down over everyone. We do have shoes hanging from the telephone wire and the requisite tires that line the path. We're going to win. We're confident.
She tells me how she made the tires.
Those are cut-in-half Entenmann's chocolate donuts. We ate a lot of them, too. They're really tasty.
There are R and even X-rated trailer parks. A trailer park called Payday at the North Pole features a reindeer stripper and a drunken Santa passed out in yellow snow. Cameron Ayers recreated a local icon.
Ours is the Starlight Drive-In, have a Christmas story playing in the background, have the light-up sign, have Palookaville, that is a local guy that sells corn dogs at the drive-in.
Gingerbread, fondant, poppy seeds, and royal icing are the building materials for this model of the last drive-in theater in Atlanta. Like most sports, a key to winning is catching your opponent off guard. That means coming up with a new way to build. One past winner used blue jello for an above-ground swimming pool. This year, there's a trailer built of matzah. According to Ayers, the game plan is a secret.
No one knows what you're doing until you show up here. You don't let on any secrets, no trade techniques, nothing. It's all very secretive and find out different ingredients, use what works best, different techniques, but no, you don't tell them before the competition.
There's a cash prize for the most creative, unique, and Christmassy entry. But Ayers says it's not about the money.
You want to win. It's bragging rights. I don't care about the prize. I want to say I was better than his was. And it's the competitiveness. It's just your nature of the sport.
This year's celebrity judge, a local top chef, didn't show. So there were just two judges, a sculptor and Deborah Vallée, a former trailer park winner. Vallée is judged for life because she first brought blue jello swimming pools to the competition. Finally, organizer Chantel Ritter stands on a table and announces the winners.
Honorable mention number 3 is lot number 7, Loretta Mae.
Jolene Beckett's victory speech isn't humble.
We labored with love and a lot of fondant and marzipan and candied whatnots. Threw it all together, and now it is the most amazing redneck vision of Christmas loveliness that you have ever seen.
Cameron Ayers gets second place for his drive-in theater.
And for first place, for $100, is lot number 8 for Jill.
The loser's disappointment is palpable, but there's always next year. For Only a Game, I'm Philip Gratzer in Atlanta.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Empire State of Mind, to which you're listening as I speak, has gone 3 times platinum. Gee, I love that kind of talk, but it has recently been edited slightly, at least in Cleveland. The lyric that once ran, "If Jeezy's paying LeBron, I'm paying Dwayne Wade," has been altered to make the name LeBron unrecognizable by disc jockey Joel Murphy. "I recognize the word LeBron was as offensive to some people as the 7 words you can't say on radio," Murphy said. Hence, he decided to bleep LeBron, and Murphy reports that listeners have said it's a brilliant idea.
Card Marley, Labor Day Parade, rest in peace, Bob Marley, Statue of Liberty, long live the World Trade, long live the King, yo, I'm from the Empire State. That's...
Hey. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, several post-Olympians hope to propel the Canadian Women's Hockey League into the big time. But first, here to discuss the Men's Hockey League trying to break into the big time, namely the NHL, is Helene Elliott of the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back, Helene.
Wait a minute. You don't consider the NHL big time?
I just couldn't resist, you know, a little kind of turnaround.
Oh,
there,
sure. But... in the spirit of the season.
Yeah,
really nice.
Yeah, right.
I hope you're proud of yourself.
It's Christmas, for goodness sake. Sidney Crosby's point streak now stands at 20 games, but Pittsburgh has lost two games in a row. Should that be a big concern for the Penguins?
No. I mean, this NHL season is so long, there's going to be times when there's the proverbial peaks and valleys, and you just can't keep up that level of play for 82 games. It would be impossible, and there's really no point in it because you'll wear yourself out before the playoffs. The way he's been playing lately, it's just an incredible statement of how good this guy is, and when he wants to and when he can. I mean, everything just falls in place for him. I mean, those were Gretzky-esque numbers, or should that be Gretzkian? I don't know, but
Gretzky-esque would probably be okay. The all-time point streak, of course, belongs to Wayne Gretzky, who notched points in 51 straight games. This is back in 1983 and 84. So is Crosby the guy who can break that record?
I think that's one of those records like DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak that I don't think will ever be broken.
Washington Capitals standout and Crosby arch-nemesis Alex Ovechkin will appear with Crosby this coming Monday on The Price is Right. What will they be doing there, and do you think it will involve intimidation or even fisticuffs on the lavish Price is Right set?
That would be great. They fight over Plinko or something, you know? Fight over the 39-cent can of tuna?
Oh,
I don't know.
Anything.
It's a promotional thing for the NHL's Winter Classic game, the outdoor game that has now become an annual tradition on New Year's Day. And the NHL, you know, to its credit, it's waking up to the fact that, you know, we have a pretty good thing here. Let's promote this. Of course, they seem to forget that there are, you know, 28 other teams in the NHL who really should be promoted as well. But as long as they have Pittsburgh and Washington to promote, they're very happy.
The two worst teams in the NHL, the New Jersey Devils and the New York Islanders, are in the Atlantic Division. I'm wondering whether the league should consider sort of realigning things and spreading the misery around by putting one of those teams in another division.
Call it the Titanic Division, I suppose. It's just been incredibly awful. And, you know, the Devils are not getting much sympathy because a lot of teams around the league thought they were crazy to pay the kind of money to Ilya Kovalchuk that they paid him this past summer as a free agent. I mean, they tried to pay him $102 million, and the league rejected the contract and ended up paying him, quote-unquote, only $100 million, which I'm sure you'd settle for.
I'd have to give it some thought.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'd settle for it. I've given it enough thought.
Okay. I like that about you. So decisive. His numbers are terrible as a team. They've been awful. And a lot of people are sitting there and kind of snickering and not bothering to hide it either.
The Coyotes' bid to stay in Phoenix cleared a hurdle this week after the team's lease agreement with the city of Glendale was renegotiated and local officials were assured that the incoming owner would keep the team where it is. Are the team, the league, and the city better off with the Coyotes in Arizona than would be the case if they moved to Ontario, say?
Well, if you're Canadian, the answer to that is no, eh? but any, you know, it's a tough one because I think that the city of Glendale, Arizona, put itself into a very deep hole by building that arena. So when Matthew Hulsizer, the Chicago businessman who wants to buy the franchise, came into the picture, I mean, he's going to get a great deal because the folks in Glendale are just so desperate to have the team stay there and not lose their shirts. They're going to give him, I think, their belts and pants and socks. It's just incredible the sweetheart deal this guy's going to get. And he's also going to get an option to buy the arena, too.
Mark Scott, the retired news director at WBFO Radio in Buffalo, wrote this week to chastise me for failing to acknowledge the death of Hall of Fame hockey writer Jim Kelly back on November 30th. Helene, how will you remember Mr. Kelly?
He was just a terrific guy with a wonderful sense of humor, couldn't spell to save his life, but he was funny and smart. I mean, I remember reading some of his raw copy and going, holy moly, and him saying, that's why there are copy editors. So he kept a lot of copy editors employed for many years, but it was what he said, not the spelling that mattered. And he was never afraid of anyone, never afraid to challenge anyone. And he just his passion for the game always came through. Even if you're scolding somebody, you knew he was doing it because it was for the betterment of the team or the game or the fans of the game. And Jim was a wonderful voice and a wonderful friend to hockey and a wonderful friend to all of us hockey writers. And we'll all miss him.
In 2 weeks, the National Hockey League's fourth annual Winter Classic will take place at Pittsburgh's Heinz Field. Weather permitting, will you be there in Pittsburgh?
No, I will not. I kind of think I retired from the outdoor game circuit after they had the one at Wrigley Field. I figured they couldn't top that one. Red Wings and Blackhawks, to me, that was the ultimate. You know, I think it's a great thing for the league. It's a great promotional tool. It's become an annual event, and people look for it, or at least the league hopes they'll be looking for it on TV. And, you know, it's one thing the league can play up and can get maybe some non-hockey fans, you know, get the casual fans to start watching the game by staging that event.
I'm rooting for the Penguins to sign Steelers safety Troy Polamalu to a one-day contract for that fourth annual Winter Classic, because I would really like to see that hair streaming out behind a hockey helmet, wouldn't you?
Oh, that would be great. I could just see that. I love that idea. I'd call Gary Bettman right now if he hadn't stopped taking my calls.
Mine too. That's what a coincidence.
Oh, no.
Aline Elliott writes for the LA Times, and we are glad that she is our go-to hockey person here at Only a Game as well. Aline, thanks and happy holidays.
You too. Thank you.
So let's remember it's December before we drop the gloves. Even goons like yourself deep down need to be loved. Lower your high stick and remember jolly old Saint Nick. Hey, you big idiot, happy holidays. Happy holidays. Happy holidays. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, everybody.
On a Sunday afternoon a couple of weeks ago, I found myself in the corridor outside the locker rooms at Bright Arena, normally the home of Harvard University's ice hockey teams. I had arranged to meet with Becky Keller, the mother of two boys, 6 and 3, though that wasn't why I'd arranged to meet with her.
With Team Canada, I've won 3 Olympic gold medals and 1 silver. 4 world championships, 3 silvers.
Becky Keller, who plays defense, joined the Burlington, Ontario Barracudas in 1997 when the Canadian Women's Hockey League first opened for business, at least a sort of business. The CWHL is incorporated in Canada as a nonprofit organization. Burlington's competition this afternoon was the Boston Blades, a team new to the league this season. Keller, who played her college hockey at Brown University, was happy to see a U.S. franchise appear on the Barracuda's schedule.
I watched so many of the girls that I graduated with stop playing because there was no elite teams here, so it's nice to see that that's happening.
In order to see just how nice Becky Keller's U.S. counterparts thought the creation of the Boston franchise was, I walked a little further down the corridor to find the closest woman to a Becky Keller counterpart the opposition could provide.
I'm Angela Ruggiero, play for the Boston Blades, and I'm a defenseman.
You hesitated with Blades. Have they just come up with a name?
We had an online vote on our Facebook page, apparently, and the public decided what our name would be. So we actually like it. We nicknamed ourselves the Bladies.
Ruggiero, like Becky Keller, has an Olympic gold medal and a World Championship gold medal in her trophy case, along with what she perhaps considers too many silvers. Reminders of all the times her teams have finished second to Canada. Ruggiero starred at Harvard and graduated cum laude in 2004, all of which has perhaps prepared her to lead the Blades, or Bladies, in their inaugural season.
It's interesting because you do have a sprinkle of Olympic athletes, a sprinkle of national team athletes, and a sprinkle of NCAA Division I and a few Division III athletes. So, you know, I think some players are playing just because they love it. They want to play at an intense level on the women's side and want to stay in shape. And others are using it as a springboard to train for their respective national teams.
It's intense and, for at least some of the players, expensive. The Barracudas willing to travel around Canada and down to Boston by bus are covered, but the ones who want to fly make up the difference themselves. And according to Paul Hendrickson, the general manager of the Boston Blades, his players can't even take meal money for granted.
Well, that depends. Each team handles that differently. We actually were able to provide meals for our entire trip up to Toronto through the generosity of some of the parents. And so each team does their best to try to use parent donations or other funds to help out a bit, but that really is something that's up to the players if the team cannot cover it.
Paul Hendrickson, like the players, hopes the league won't always be dependent on the kindness of relatives and friends. He dreams of self-sufficiency and more.
We're definitely hoping to get there. That will require two things. One is sponsorships, corporate sponsorships. They're really key to a league like this. But we also have to build attendance. And those two things go together. As we build attendance, we'll be a more attractive place for sponsors. So we hope to be there. We're not there yet.
Until the CWHL is there, that is financially solid enough to actually pay the players, said players have to find day jobs where they can. Lots of them are involved in coaching at colleges or schools, which means their responsibilities sometimes conflict with their CWHL team practices. Others, according to Pat Coughlin, who coaches the Burlington Barracudas, find other ways to make a living.
Some of them are work in the dental. Some of them work in data entry. Some of them do guest speaking. Some of them just train hockey players. You know, they're all different fields. Some of them are law assistants. It's amazing what they do away from hockey. Some of them are trying to raise two kids, so we try and help her out with that as much as we can. So, you know, we try and help her out with the kids. We take them on the bus for her while she's getting ready and stuff. So, you know, they really have to sacrifice more than, say, the boys would have to sacrifice.
Coughlin, who has also coached men's hockey, says the circumstances of his current players have required adjustments on his part.
You do have to coach them a little bit differently because they have jobs and they have other commitments that maybe are a little higher than just the hockey. You know, whereas those boys are trying to advance to pro careers, and you know, you have to train them and treat them differently for sure.
The hockey itself is not so different, at least according to Martha Curran, one of the few fans on hand when the game between the Blades and the Barracudas began.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience. It's disappointing that there aren't more folks here because I just think, you know, it's like almost seeing Olympic level hockey, you know, in your own backyard.
I'm very bad at estimating crowds. Would you like to give me a crowd estimate here?
I am bad at that also, but I would say there's not more than 50 or so people here.
According to the official league statistics, the actual count was 60, but that might have included the officials and Becky Keller's children. Those who had managed to find their way to Bright Arena were rewarded with a tight, well-played game, which the visiting Barracudas won 2-1. Perhaps some of the 50 or 60 people who were in attendance will one day look back on the afternoon and say they were present when a CWHL game looked like a private party. Angela Ruggiero is among those who believe that with help from the International Hockey Federation and others, a change can come.
I see this league actually 5-10 years down the road as the place for post-collegiate players around the world to come. So it isn't just, you know, the North American powerhouses again. It's everyone coming here, and you know, the IAHF could help support that. The NHL could help support that. The main thing is everyone's having a good time out there and you know, enjoying being out on the ice with each other. I know the Blades certainly are.
In today's CWHL action, Angela Ruggiero and the second-place Boston Blades will face league-leading Montreal in Montreal, and Toronto will play Brampton in Brampton. Plenty of good seats still available for now. You're listening to Only a Game. Last week's edition of the annual Only a Game Sports Holiday Gift Guide appears to have helped some listeners with their last-minute shopping. Lisa Chavanti Craig wrote to say that she had ordered a desktop Zamboni for the hard-to-buy hockey fan on her list. Kathy Runyon, any relation to the late and exceedingly great Damon, I wonder, wrote to celebrate the American flag art made from three used baseballs as the perfect gift for her husband. In a burst of candor, she wrote, "I usually don't pay a lot of attention to Only a Game, but I'm very glad I did this morning. You made my day." Jim Koons, who hears the program on WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, enjoyed the music that accompanied the cavalcade of gifts. "I almost fell out of my chair when I heard Here Comes Santa Claus from the Spike Jonze Christmas album circa 1956, he wrote. "My father loved that album, and it became a staple of the whole Christmas experience for our family, something nobody I know seems to understand or appreciate, so we've got something in common." The world's most enthusiastic San Francisco Giants fan, the New England Sports Museum's Richard Johnson, is still celebrating his club's autumn triumph. He mailed in a handful of haiku on Thursday, my favorite of which reads, "Renteria swings, no Bobby Richardson there to shatter the dream." Maybe you had to be a Willie McCovey fan in 1962 to get the full impact of that one. And finally, Chris Collins emailed to take issue with Dan Kleppel of the Louisville Courier-Journal, with whom I spoke last week about the possibility of Louisville acquiring an NBA franchise. Mr. Collins wrote, "Contrary to what Dan Kleppel said, the majority of people are not in favor of an NBA team coming here. Who can afford the tickets? The local residents are already spending their entertainment dollars supporting three legendary college teams. People around here can't afford the season ticket that would cost at least $60 a seat times 41 home games." You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org, where you'll still find our sports gift guide. You can leave a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com. This is NPR.
On Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI took a break from his customary duties at the Vatican and he made time for sports. The Pope was briefly entertained by the Fratelli Pellegrini, four acrobats who performed handstands, lifted and tossed themselves into various poses, and at one point created an improbable human tower. Some observers may have been dismayed that the members of Fratelli Pellegrini removed their shirts before they performed, but not the Pope. He clapped and greeted the acrobats at the end of their performance, which was part of a convention on circuses organized by the Vatican's Office for Migrants. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Cleveland sports columnist Terry Pluto writes a book with the assistance of about 1,000 long-suffering Browns fans. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill, and Merry Christmas to everybody out there.
And happy holidays from me as well. The Metrodome is still buckling under the weight of Minnesota snow, so the Vikings and the Bears will play Monday's game at the outdoor home of the University of Minnesota Gophers, where for 2 days, Vikings fans made $10 an hour digging the place out from under the snow. But there have been concerns about the suitability of that venue. What are the concerns?
Well, my biggest concern is the fact that an institution of higher learning plays its football at something called TCF Bank Stadium, which would sort of like belie the whole notion of amateur sports and what have you.
A tattered notion at best.
I mean, by this point. I presume that both the Bears and the Bears played in miserable weather last week, so they're acclimated to it. I'm sure the Vikings can adjust. I don't have a problem with this at all. I can say, though, that I do have some experience, because in 1972, there was a sneak snowstorm in Milwaukee on opening day of the baseball season. The Red Sox, in fact, were supposed to play there and never get out of Florida, and I made $5 an hour shoveling off the bleachers in Old County Stadium in Milwaukee. So out there in Minneapolis, I sympathize with y'all.
And back then, $5 was some real money.
$5 was some real bratwurst money, pal.
All right, it's quiz time. What NFL star said this week, quote, "I miss having a dog, and my daughters miss having one, too."
Yeah, Michael Vick wants to own a dog. Contacted at the kennel. The dog said, "Rawr, rawr, rawr."
No.
Mike, start with fish, okay? And not piranhas either. Nice little goldfish without teeth, and we'll see where it goes.
Sal Alossi, late an assistant coach with the New York Jets, has been indefinitely suspended by the team for the sideline strategy that he had been implementing. He tripped a guy on the other team. Shouldn't this guy have been fired?
Well, I don't know. This is something. This is apparently falling into the "we don't know whether or not this is gamesmanship or bad for the league" thing yet. And so you throw the strength coach out because you can always find another strength coach. I think there are probably people at slightly above Sal's pay grade who were involved in this who we're never going to hear anything about.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced this week that a new labor agreement could be in place by the Super Bowl. Charlie, the last time I checked, collective bargaining required two parties. Are the players similarly optimistic?
This is a great announcement by the commissioner. Hey, the NFL negotiators are ready right now. Agree to what we want,
and we got a deal.
The NFLPA guy, Carl Francis, did the smart thing and said, "We have no comment on this at this time."
The College Bowl season begins today. Which BCS mini-dramas will you be watching?
Well, we don't have any BCS mini-dramas for a while, but the ones of the games today, I really will probably not watch any of them, although I do like the R&L Carriers Bowl in New Orleans in the Superdome because it says Ohio versus Troy. And I think the whole notion of Ohio and Troy is a good thing. You couldn't beat the Greeks, but you build a giant wooden Buckeye.
Slip it right through the gates.
Actually, it's Ohio University. You build a giant wooden whatever they are, and you slip it through the gates and win.
His attempts to buy into Major League Baseball having failed, Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban has decided to put his money toward establishing a playoff format for college football. Any chance he'll succeed?
Well, the world's smartest human, just ask him, has come up with another great idea. He's proposing that he's got enough money that he can bribe college football teams much better than the BCS can with their Helen of Troy hair dryers and their Best Buy gift certificates. The problem is, as soon as one team agrees to this, they will be put on probation by the NCAA for 8 zillion years. Mm-hmm. So it's very unlikely this will come to pass.
Everybody who was sure that Cliff Lee would either continue his pitching career with the Texas Rangers or go to work for the Yankees was wrong. On Wednesday, Lee signed with the Phillies, for whom he had pitched during part of the 2009 season. Lee claims that the Phillies' 2011 rotation will be, quote, historic. He doesn't just mean old, does he?
No, he doesn't. But Roy Oswalt, Cole Hamels, Roy Halladay, and him, that's a pretty good rotation on a very, very good baseball team. It was interesting that one of the reasons he went, according to his wife, was that they like being in Philadelphia because you can hop on a train and be in New York and Washington. A professional baseball player who's actually in favor of trains. High-speed rail. Cliff Lee, the spokesman. I like it.
Ever since the 2004 seizure of a list of 104 Major League Baseball players who had tested positive for steroids back in 2003, you, Charlie, have opined that the government acted illegally, and now the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco has agreed with you.
And
shouldn't this have been determined quite a long time ago?
Well, I think these things do take a lot of time, and apparently the Solicitor General is not going to ask the Supreme Court to reverse the ruling. The people who seized this list got what they wanted, which was to basically get the names out and raise the pressure on these people and to hell with their constitutional rights. So, yeah, I think the reason the government's not going to contest this up to the United States Supreme Court is basically because they got what they wanted in the first place by seizing this unconstitutionally and illegally.
By order of the NCAA, the baseball team at Arizona State has been banned from next year's postseason, and all of the team's wins from the 2007 season have been vacated. Wait, the baseball team?
Apparently, 500 impermissible recruiting calls. And former coach Pat Murphy, quote, failed to promote an atmosphere for compliance from 2004 to 2008. This is a big whack for a baseball program.
As we discussed last week, Russia will host the 2018 World Cup, and this week Prime Minister Vladimir Putin said that the opportunity would help reduce crime in Russia and make the nation healthier. How so, I wonder?
Because if it doesn't, he will kill everyone.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No, yeah, Vladimir is going to flex his muscles. There will be less crime and less drug taking, says Putin, which obviously puts them out of the running for the Olympics anytime soon.
Meanwhile, the man who announced that Russia will host the 2018 World Cup and that the 2022 event will transpire in Qatar, where gays are regarded as criminals, said this week that gays who visit Qatar in 2022 should, quote, refrain from any sexual activity. Sound like a plan?
Yeah, Sepp Blatter, international man of morons, strikes again. Human rights groups will be climbing in his ear now from now until 2022. I don't know what he accomplished by this, but as I said, there's no plumbing the depths to which somebody condemned to the name Sepp Blatter for his entire life might go.
I should update this story by saying that Mr. Blatter has issued one of those wonderful apologies which begins, "If I offended anybody."
You did!
And finally, Charlie, in the spirit of the season, I give you a world record that should have you blurting,
"Sports!"
And what would it
Sports!
Be?
This is great. A guy with 25,189 pieces of Santa Claus memorabilia. I mean, with that kind of collection, shouldn't you be eating, like, flank steak from Blitzen for your holiday meal?
Records are records. Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and his story about New England Patriots receiver Wes Welker titled Do You See What He Sees? Appears in the December 20th issue of Sports Illustrated. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks,
and
Bill.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you and yours.
If you'd like more information about Only a Game's music selections, please check out our weekly music blog by visiting us at onlyagame.org. Historically, the Cleveland Browns are not the worst team in the National Football League. The Lions are a little worse. But the Browns last won a championship in 1964, and they have disappointed their fans by drafting badly, by fumbling when fumbling could do maximum damage, and by leaving town. In his new book, Cleveland Plain Dealer sports columnist Terry Pluto treats following the Browns as an opportunity for growth of a sort. The book is Things I've Learned from Watching the Browns, and Terry Pluto joins me now from WKSU in Akron, Ohio. Terry, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hello, Mr. Littlefield.
You're actually sort of a co-author for this book. Right on the front, it says it was written by you and, quote, hundreds of Browns fans. How did this writing partnership come about?
Well, I wanted to do kind of an informal history of the Browns, but I didn't want to do the usual way where you go talk to, you know, former players and coaches, which I did. I interviewed Bernie Carlozar and Brian Sipe and Sam Artigliano and Paul Warfield. But what I also wanted to do is get a perspective of the fans on the franchise and what the Browns mean to them. And frankly, why do you keep following this horrible franchise and what it's done to people for the last 40 years? And I just put it in the Plain Dealer once that I was writing this book with a couple of ideas and send me emails. And I expected maybe 250, 300. I got over 1,000 just once, and I suddenly realized these people want it, and they go, I want to be in this book. I want to tell the story. It makes no sense that I follow this team, but I do, and here's why.
A lot of writers have waxed poetic about what it was like the first time they walked into a Major League Baseball park and they saw the impossibly green grass and the impossibly white home uniforms. But writing about the Browns' home games, you give us this, quote, ah, the memories of drunks throwing bottles where parts of the stadium smelled like an animal died years ago, but no one can find the carcass. Why does anybody go back?
And they revel in that. Furthermore, while the baseball fan talks about the sun-splashed fields and all that, in Cleveland they talk about the wind off the lake and your nose running till it freezes and your and you're just shaking in your boots. And just when you think the Browns are going to win, they call Red Right 88, and Brian Sipe throws an interception in the end zone, throwing to the wrong receiver at the wrong time. And then you walk out of the ballpark saying, I guess I'm still a Browns fan, but don't ask me why right now.
There are several heroic figures in this book, Terry, players who fought and lost and rose to fight again. But is it fair to say that former Browns quarterback Bernie Kosar dwarfs them all?
Oh, yes. I could have done an entire book of Bernie emails. Bernie grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, went to University of Miami in Florida, which actually it was interesting. I always wanted to know why he went there. It turned out he wanted to go to Ohio State, wanted to go to Penn State, wanted to go to Notre Dame, and none of them wanted him.
Mm-hmm.
So he went down to Miami in Florida, won a national title, was a really good player, got his degree in finance in 3 years, and then entered the draft early and kind of finagled, let everybody know he wanted to play for Cleveland. They pulled a trade, brought him up here. He ended up being a good player. And more people in their emails use this phrase for Bernie: he chose us. And let's face it, after all the things you just saw with LeBron James, whatever, it was somebody chose Cleveland to live and, you know, play in the snow and all that stuff. It meant so much. And, of course, Bernie, if you watched him play, was kind of like a giraffe trying to throw a watermelon. It was not pretty. But he would get this. He would probably explain that himself. In fact, he made fun of how unathletic he was.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, you know, he was a remarkably accurate passer in his own weird way, a sidearm with all kinds of arms and legs going in different directions. Very, very tough guy. And, of course, in true Browns fashion, Bill Belichick came in here. That was before Bill Belichick won a whole bunch of Super Bowls and became an icon. Here he just looked like a young, egotistical coach who couldn't wait to cut Bernie Kosar in the middle of the 1993 season. Bernie went on to be a backup in Dallas, and actually he's lived between here and Miami since. But anywhere he goes, I mean, he has signed more autographs. I mean, he and Bob Feller are like the two icons of Cleveland sports.
Is he aware of how important he still is to lots and lots of Browns fans?
I really think he is, and especially the last couple of years where he's been getting some treatment for these different for his concussions and other problems. It's helped him appreciate, because he went through a really ugly divorce, a bankruptcy, and Cleveland did not abandon its native son at all. If anything, people, the business community rallied around him to help him. And when you watch him with people, he always says it's easier to be nice for 30 to 45 seconds to someone, pose for the picture, sign the autograph, hug the baby, than it is to act like a jerk, and then suddenly you're in the middle of this horrible stare down and standoff. And also, it's just nice with him. He comes from a steelworking area, and he kind of, even though he got that degree in 3 years, he just sounds like he sort of walked out of the mill, and he doesn't seem to act like he's all that special, but he gets it, the fact that he is special to a lot of people.
At least one of your correspondents referred to Art Modell's moving the Browns out of Cleveland in 1995 as, quote, the dagger wound to the heart that has still not healed. Regarding your book's title, what did Cleveland fans learn from that episode?
It learned how the NFL is a bigger, crueler, more heartless business than they ever expected. Because even when Art Modell was complaining about the lack of a new stadium and all these problems, the Browns were still anywhere from 5th to 8th in attendance in the league. How about this, Bill? The day the move was announced, the next 24 hours, they sold over 600 tickets. I don't know why, to watch the remaining games. I don't know why anybody would spend a dime. And the remaining games that year, I believe there were four, they averaged in the high 50,000s. And those are real people in the seats. I was covering these games going, why is anyone here? You've got the ultimate betrayal. But see, to them, it was like a last pilgrimage.
Hmm.
You know, they went to the seats that their grandfathers, I mean, these seats are passed down from generation to generation. At least they were at the old stadium. Of course, Bill, the thing was, at the last home game, people came to the game like with their Black & Decker power tools and tool belts, and they began ripping the chairs out that they had. Because the game's over. Now you hear all this pounding of things. You think it was like, you know, a Carpenters Union meeting, and they were practicing, and they hauled their seats out with them as they left.
Have you a favorite among all the emails you received from Browns fans?
There were two of them. One guy wrote, he said, you know, when the Browns are bad, they're just awful. And when they're good, they're excruciating. Because he meant how close they come to winning, but they don't. Another guy wrote, I don't blame Art Modell for the move, and I don't blame Ernest Biner for the fumble, and I don't blame Brian Sipe for Red Right 88, and I don't blame John Elway for the drive. I blame my ancestors who 200 years ago came from Ireland to this country and could have settled anywhere, and they picked Cleveland and stuck me with the Browns. In fact, I get an email from a guy, I love this. He was actually talking about, in a bar in Hawaii, about how John Elway wrecked them with the drive and all and these type of things. And then all of a sudden, he gets a drink sent over to him, said, I'm sorry I ruined your childhood, John Elway. And Elway was sitting in the other part of the bar and heard this story. And see, that's why I wanted the emails, Bill. You can't make this stuff up.
Terry Pluto is the author of Things I've Learned from Watching the Browns, or at least he's one of the authors. The book is published by Gray & Company, and Terry Pluto joined me from WKSU in Akron. Terry, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
On the first day of Christmas, Art Modell gave to me a Ridigliano Super Bowl team. On the second day of Christmas, Art Modell gave to me Don Cockcroft kicking on a Ridigliano Super Bowl team.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our long-serving intern. Jack, best wishes beyond the toy department. We had help this week from Tim Rudell at WKSU in Akron, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view my Boston Bladies photo gallery or Philip Gratzer's Gingerbread Trailer Park pictures, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Terry Pluto, who offers this thumbnail history of Cleveland's fabled dog pound.
So now they're barking, and the defensive guys are barking, and everybody's barking, so that became a place where everybody was barking when they weren't yelling or passed out.
Football, what's not to love? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Al's A to attack and Brian Sipe passing Don Cockcroft kicking on a Ridigliano Super Bowl team. On the fifth day of Christmas, Art Modell gave to me both the Pruitt's moves. Al's A to attack and Brian Sipe passing Don Cockcroft kicking on a Ridigliano Super Bowl team.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.